third of the series looking at Te Koho I Te Maunga, the Sermon on the Mount. Last week, we've had a look at Jesus appears to be really interested in people flourishing and doing well, and we noticed that the place of blessing, the place of flourishing that Jesus talks about, isn't necessarily in the places we would expect. It's often in the places where we don't have. Often in the places where we don't have much power, in our lack, our pain, less from a position of power, which is really the opposite of what we're used to. We kind of expect that you start by speaking to the rich and powerful and that it trickles down, but actually Jesus doesn't do it this way. He turns it backwards. And as it happens, the Bible Project is doing a year-long focus on this sermon, and I'd just like to play you a little clip that shows you a little hint of what's going on in terms of power. So let's hope that this works, and we should have some sound,
these
I hope.
These people are not powerful or important, but just wait, Jesus says, because one day it will be you all who are ruling the world.
You know, it kind of sounds like Jesus is trying to start a revolution.
Well, kind of, but it's not a revolution for those who are hungry for power or influence. This is a movement of people who are going to serve because they long for healthy relationships between people and communities and nations.
Yeah, as Jesus said next, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy.
Just imagine it. A group of powerless nobodies ruling the world through generosity and forgiveness and justice. This is a Jesus-style revolution.
So I love the imagery of that, a Jesus-style revolution. And I don't know if you noticed at the start, the king was sitting on his throne, and there's this peasant down there, and suddenly it swaps. And you can see this kind of shock as that happens. And then the peasant comes down and puts her crown on the king. That's really kingdom of God kind of values. I think this is great stuff. So what we've been doing is we've been listening to three different new translations. And using the new translations, we talked about how the word blessed has connotations in New Zealand, in the West that are probably not that helpful for us. So there's a bit of a shift. And here's the first one. This is the Bible Project themselves having a go at writing it, and they say, the good life belongs to those who hunger and thirst for righteousness because they will be satisfied. The good life belongs to those who show mercy because they will be shown mercy. The good life belongs to the pure in heart because they will see God. Now, obviously, we're going to want to think about some of the words here. There are sort of conditions and there are results. The results, because they will be satisfied, they will be shown mercy, they will see God. The conditions, I've got this wrong, haven't I? My placement is wrong, never mind. Remember, it's not saying God's going to give this from heaven, The good life belongs to us, a way of saying those people in this place, those people who are hungry and thirsty, there's some good stuff that happens. Let's have a look at a different version, seeing as I completely blow my highlights. This is from N.T. Wright. Wonderful news for people who hunger and thirst for God's justice. You're going to be satisfied. Wonderful news for the merciful. You'll receive mercy yourselves. Wonderful news for the pure in heart. You will see God. Each of those promises, the blessing part, is a future tense. This is going to come your way. It's not necessarily saying you have it now, but this is going to be the result. Okay, one more translation. And this is from the scholar who first kind of identified that what we put in our current Bibles is maybe not the most helpful. And he says, flourishing are the ones hungering and thirsting for righteousness, because they will be satisfied. Flourishing are the merciful because they will be given mercy. Flourishing are the pure in heart because they will see God. So some similarities there, aren't they? Let's have a look at the first one. Can I just note, what it doesn't say is what I think a priest or a Pharisee would want to have heard. Flourishing are the righteous. That's kind of what we would expect from wisdom-style literature, how good it is to be a right and just person, it does not say that. And actually, while we're thinking about that, remember that the scholars, when they're translating this stuff, they actually have a fight that goes on between using the word righteousness or using the word justice, because they're interwoven. It's not something that you own. It's a state that can be achieved, which is unusual for wisdom writing. Actually, Psalms and Proverbs are full of comparing the righteous and the wicked. Proverbs 4:18, but the path of the righteous is like the light of dawn, which shines brighter and brighter until the day. So, hang on, I've got to get confused myself here. Jesus doesn't say, flourishing are the righteous. He says, flourishing are those who hunger and thirst. They're not necessarily there, but they want to be there. There's some dissatisfaction in wanting it to be different. So, like that proverb, it's probably a pathway rather than a state. That's what I meant to say earlier. So if you say flourishing are the righteous, you're saying, well, when you're in this place, you're here. And actually Jesus says, no, if you're on the road towards this, if you're leaning towards this, if you're drawn towards this. So he's not speaking to the righteous, but those who are hungry for it. And last week we put up this an image, which I've made a bit coarser here, of a road that's like a yellow brick road leading to the city of lights. This is people on the road heading towards that. Am I cutting in and out? No, that's great. Excellent. Now, I'm kind of pleased it doesn't say flourishing are the righteous, because would that be me? And I would think that way because I'm a Westerner. I think individualistically. I don't think of righteousness as a thing that's got to do with everyone, which should change. There was a Jewish philosopher who got caught in the concentration camps. I believe this one is Viktor Frankl, but I'm a little bit confused. I'm not sure if I've confused with someone else. And he made some observations as to how people survived in a concentration camp. And what he said was, he saw three groups of people. The first group of people he saw in this concentration camp, he said, were the saints. And the saints were the people who, so-and-so's going to be, strung up on a cross or punished or given extra work duty, and they'd say, I'll do it for you, because they could see what terrible position they were in. And his observation about saints was, they are absolutely stunning, but they didn't live very long. Yep. And then he saw, on the other end of the scale, he saw a group of people which, he said, these... So the saints held really high ideals, but they weren't going to live very long. And then he saw a whole bunch of people who just gave up on all their ideals. They would just do whatever it took to live. And he called them zombies. Zombies because they lost a sense of what it was to be human. They would just do anything to survive. That's a pretty harsh setting. And then the interesting part for me about Viktor Frankl is he said that, and then there was the rest of us. And he said, this was him too. He said, the people kind of in the middle, Wainanui, who just didn't have it in them to be a saint. Yeah, sure, kill me. But didn't want to be a zombie. They could see how awful that was. They found themselves caught in this middle. And he observed that was most of the people there. Neither extreme was that. He didn't think they were either great. And I found that really interesting when I read Blessed Are Those Who Hunger for righteousness. I think that is a hunger to be the saint. It's a hunger to move there. But it's not a flat out, you are there. Yep. And I personally find that encouraging because I hunger. So it's not the righteous he's speaking to, but those who are hungry, those who are on a journey. And righteousness is a complicated word. It's a complicated world because in our world, we tend to think of it as something that you own. But in their world, they looked forward to a time when things would be right, when they would talk about shalom. They saw that everything was connected and that things could be in a bad state or they could be right or just, and you'd wind these things together. Now, I'm saying it's so not righteousness as a state. So if I've eaten lots, I might say I'm stuffed. I'm full, that's my state. But Righteousness is more relational for them. So the rich young man who approached Jesus, he probably thought he was righteous when he goes up to Jesus and says, "Hey, can you just, you know, give me the inside tickets?" And Jesus reminds him he's in a network of relationships, which is how we live. We are constantly in relationships, and the biblical, as I understand it, a Jewish concept of righteousness and justice is to be in a state where your relationships are right. Relationships with God, relationships with others, relationships with the world. And if everyone is doing it, we end up with a place of shalom where everything is right. And as I understand it, that is how indigenous people from a variety of settings think. I understand it, that's really deep in Maori tikanga, a desire, here it calls it tuwa, the goal of life, to have everything in as it should be is the way to think of it. And tapu, sacredness and protection, mana, power, influence, truth, pono, tika, aroha, love, these are all contributors to getting to the right place to be. And you hear me saying that there's places where I think Māori, tikanga and kaupapa are rich. I think this is an area their default is actually quite a good longing compared to mine, which is very individualistic. I'll speak for me. I'm a Westerner, I'm a product of this, and I look over at this other culture and think, your desire here, this really relational desire, that's really good. That's got a lot of biblical hunger in it. So I think it's a pathway. I think it's a hunger, a roadway with a destination and a good destination. And I don't think it's only a spiritual thing. In Matthew 13:44, Jesus tells a couple of parables. One is about someone who finds treasure in a field, and the other one is a man searching for a pearl. Do you remember those? And interestingly, in the second story, when Jesus talks of the merchant searching for a pearl, the kingdom of God is not compared to the pearl. It's compared to the search for the pearl. Right, so there's something about the hunger, the desire to be here, a movement, desires and relationships. So what that means, if you're coming to church and praying, but at home you're beating or browbeating your spouse, well, you are not in good relationships. That seems pretty obvious, doesn't it? If you're gossiping about others and savoring the pleasure in their fallings, are you in good relationship with them? No. In the West, I feel a bit nervous about this one, where we seem to live unsustainably, where our relationship with the environment against us, is this right? Is it, I'm going to call it, righteousness? Well, I think probably not. I think we have increasingly a hunger to go, can we get this better? Can we get this righter? I don't think many of us could claim to be righteous, but that's not the goal. The goal is to be on that road, to be hungry for that. So that when God reconciles all things, we'll be part of right relationship with everyone and everything, which would be pretty glorious. Which reminds me of an old advertisement. Brace yourselves.
Gewone instantpoeder, de ander Mokona, fris gedroogd. Wat is het verschil? Eerst proef ik de gewone koffie. En dan de Mokona. Dat is het. Mokona heeft meer...
Okay, I played that for a few reasons. One, it was a shout-out to anyone with Dutch origin. That was Dutch? Excellent, excellent. Another was it lightened things, because, you know. And one more reason that there's a sort of an insider joke in here. In Maori, the word for satisfied is mākona. I think it's kind of cool. Mākona, heft, mur, mmm. Try it with me. Mmm. And I mention that because it is to be hungry for a time with more when God brings the world to a state of right relationships. I think that's kind of glorious. When we have set aside our grudges with others, when we forgive more than we forgive and forgive more than 7 times 7, when we find a way to live in right relationship with God and creation, it'll be and we could be hungry and thirsty for that. That would be good. That's tricky, because our whole economy is built on us being hungry and thirsty, but not for justice and righteousness. Our economy is built on us wanting stuff. And one monk wrote, this is why we have to pray. Because he said, on the surface, we're all hungry for clothes and gadgets and cars and furniture. But what real prayer does is stir holy desire, but not always satisfy it. As the unconscious bubbles up, you find out what you really desire. You get past the superficial to the place where you understand you want things to be right. But because we live so much here rather than here, well, I'll buy it. Okay, take a breath. That was a bit... Okay, now Jesus doesn't tell us to do this. He says, if you are here, there is a flourishing that comes with that. And I love it. The promise is that you will be satisfied, which I think we need, because if you are hungry for... Well, we'll get there. Okay, second thing. Flourishing are the merciful, because they will be given mercy. Now, how would you describe merciful? Mercy. Forgiveness? Compassion? Empathy? Love? I suspect some combination of all these things. It's like the mystery of forgiveness, unearned, not deserved, not owed. But if you give mercy, mercy will be returned. And you see this echoed in the Lord's Prayer we prayed earlier. And you would hope that a community that was seeking to follow Jesus would be marked by a sense of mercy. And the promise is that if we are giving away mercy, we will receive mercy. And the thing that seemed to annoy Jesus most of all were the religious people and the rulers who didn't extend mercy. Again and again and again, they will choose the letter of the law and forget the mercy side. So, what have we got so far? Seek rightness, hunger for righteousness and justice. And I'm going to say in relationships, and be merciful. Live like this and you'll be given mercy. As with many things in following Jesus, this becomes less about buying and selling and evaluating and more about gift. Mercy and forgiveness is a gift you extend to someone else. Stepping outside of our economic systems, I like to think of it as an echo of the grace that God embodies, that God first of all loves. I read someone who said that they once saw God's mercy as a patient, benevolent tolerance, a kind of grudging forgiveness. And now they said mercy has become for them God's self-understanding, a loving allowing, they said, a willing breaking of the rules by the one who made the rules. A wink, a smile, a firm, joyful taking our hand while we clutch at our sins and gaze at God in desire and disbelief. That may or may not be true, but certainly compassion and love are woven in there. Okay, last one. Blessed are the pure in heart, because they will see God. And there is that second theme we talked about at the beginning, wholeness, being wholehearted, pure of heart. As our hearts become more honest and lined up with the right maker, saviour, we see more of the God that we struggle to look at in the eyes. I reckon these three are interwoven, and I think it's quite important that they are. And they lead, if we're going to talk about that pathway, here's a quote from Isaiah 32, "Justice will dwell in the wilderness, righteousness abide in the fruitful field. The effect of righteousness will be peace. The result of righteousness, quietness and trust forever. My people will abide in peaceful habitation, in secure dwellings and quiet resting places." The place of Now, I think they're interwoven. I think they're interwoven because if your sole focus becomes righteousness, seeking that rightness and justice, what tends to happen? Well, You'll go to all the protests. I've been trying to build up this jigsaw puzzle. Here's the first one. Not fair, because it doesn't have to be protesting, but this would be a Mother Teresa. This would be a standing out for, we want a difference. And you may find yourself feeling angry a lot. It's not wrong to be angry, but angry with the complacent people who are next to you. Because you might be at all the protests and on the steps of Parliament and the people next to you aren't. Or you might despair. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I know a lot of people have given up listening to the news or reading it or watching the newspaper. Why is that? Because we despair that we'll ever get to a right place. Because it's overwhelming. This is what a sole focus on hungering and thirsting from righteousness can bring. It's all bad and it's overwhelming, so you give up. But it gets tempered as soon as you add, flourishing are those who are the merciful, because they will be given mercy. So by all means, please, let's seek better relationships with our world, in politics, with how we deal with the poor. At the same stage, we have to show mercy to all, even the decision makers, even the people we might want to blame. And lastly, the call to purity of heart is a reminder that who we are matters. And I'll tell you what, as soon as you're looking at that, it gets a little bit harder to pass judgment of others, or so I would hope. I'm straying into my own area here. The one of these things that you can feel like you're doing alone easiest is to claim that you are to pay attention to you. And we're an individualist culture, so we tend in churches to talk a lot about purity of heart. Churches make this a focus. And some of those churches end up withdrawing from the messy stuff of society. They hold great worship and prayer meetings, but don't seem to show that hunger and thirst for righteousness. And I'm a little nervous, because when that happens, I think the church has had a tendency to focus on the kind of sins that they feel like are not theirs, right? That don't hit themselves. It worries me. It worries me that the worldwide church has probably put more energy into discussion of other people's sexuality than they have into actually how lust affects everyone. It just worries me, because if I'm talking about someone else's thing, then I can point the finger and feel like I can have the discussion and I'm safe. But actually, if I was going to talk about lust, well, I can't do that. Because actually, I'd guess most people here have issues. I remember a Catholic priest, I quite like this, who said, I've taken a lot of confessions. Do you know, no one has ever confessed the last commandment. What's the last commandment? Pop quiz. It's no lusting after your neighbor's house or wife or servant or maid or ox or donkey. Don't set your heart on anything that is your neighbor's. Our economic system is built on this. Keeping up with the Joneses. How many times do you visit someone's house, see something and think, oh, I want me one of those? We don't talk about that stuff so much because it's uncomfortable. It is easier to talk about what we see as other people's sins. I'm not talking about this church. I'm talking about my observation have been in church life. And I get a little distressed because we are taking on, I'm doing it myself, we're taking on this left-wing, right-wing thing. And actually, if you trot these three attributes, again, left and right thing, it's interesting. Flourishing are those who are hungering and thirsting for righteousness, because they will be satisfied. Well, probably left and right wing tend to think the pathway towards that rightness is a different pathway. Right? Focus on this or focus on that. That's okay, but are we being merciful? And are we paying attention to our purity of heart? I suspect if this is our focus, it changes the way we seem to polarize. Now, is this us? What do you think? Are we like this? Well, I think we are on our good days. I really do. The a past mayor of Christchurch, Gary Moore, went publicly round the place to churches and said, "Hey guys, if you took the Christians and the Christian organisations out of Christchurch, the city wouldn't run, it would collapse." All the social agencies, how many Christians are working in the health service because they got there because they have a desire to see this place better? Because they have a hunger and thirst for justice and rightness. A lot. I think this is here. If you took out our city missions, Presbyterian Care, Salvation Army, Rehab, Kingdom Resources, Delta, Person-to-Person Trust, the city just wouldn't work. I think we're like this on our good days, hungering for a better world, showing mercy, paying attention to our internal state. And this is the kind of people that Jesus is gathering. This is the kind of kingdom he's expressing. And if you want to think about what kind of society that is, one writer, sorry, this is a little bit techie, says, first thing attribute of that is it's voluntary. You can't be part of this by being born into it. You actually have to make a call. There are no second generation members. You decide, I want to be part of this. The second marker that was astonishing for their day is this was mixed. It was people who were Jewish and Gentile, the rich and the poor of different classes, that didn't happen, and male and female, and they all get more than female. That must have been that last commandment sneaking in, I'm going to go and buy something. It was entirely different, and then it talked about a new way to live, and here we go. This writer talks about that new way to live. Here's what he says. When he called the society together, Jesus gave its members a new way of living. He gave them a new way to deal with offenders by forgiving them. A new way to deal with violence by suffering. Now, we'll hear a bit more of that in the last triad. Flourishing is not a place without pain. He gave them a new way to deal with money, sharing it. He gave them a new way to deal with the problems of leadership by drawing on the gift of every member, even the most humble. It's a guy called Stanley Hauerwas, and then he continued on. He gave them a new way to deal with a corrupt society, the society of Rome, by building a new order, not by smashing the old one. He gave them a new pattern of relationships between man and woman, parent and child, master and slave, in which was made concrete a radical new vision of what it means to be human. He gave them a new attitude towards the state and towards the enemy nation. This is what's talked about in this Sermon on the Mount. Now, some of you have seen this on Facebook, and Desmond Tutu, who was a major influence in South Africa's road out of apartheid, was asked by the BBC to identify the most defining moment in his life. And he spoke of the day when he and his mum were walking down the street. He was 9 years old, and a tall white man dressed in a black suit came towards them. Now, in those days, in South African apartheid, when a black person and a white person met on the footpath, the black person was supposed to step off the footpath and nod their head as a gesture of respect. But before they could do that, the white man stepped off the sidewalk, and as they passed, he tipped his hat. And Desmond Tutu, as a seven-year-old, asked, "Who was that?" And his mother said, "That's a man of God. He was an Anglican priest." That was the day that Desmond Tutu decided that he wanted to be an Anglican priest. Just this really little gesture. In fact, he says, "What is more, I wanted to be a man of God." These values get lived out in little gestures. My value system is this, so I will, because I'm hungry and thirsty for righteousness. It is a little bit why I'm quite keen for you to come and watch these, come to these workshops on a Sunday night. There's a little bit for me that says, how does a hunger and thirst for righteousness look in New Zealand? Let's get some data and let's talk about that. Flourishing are the ones hungering and thirsting for righteousness, because they will be satisfied. Flourishing are the merciful, because they will be given mercy. Flourishing are the pure in heart, because they will see God. My guess is that everyone here will tend to lean towards one of these. We'll have one where we think, actually, that's it. Other people might say to me, man, you are so empathetic. You know, you're really good at mercy. My observation in, I've been a minister for a long time, in Baptist churches, I wish we were better at holding our prophets, the guys who are really hungering and thirsting for righteousness, because they can be quite awkward to be around. They ask questions, say awkward things, and yet what they have, what they are hungering for, we also should be hungering for. I think it's worth identifying, hey, these are the things where I'm strong, and probably worth recognizing, and I'm probably not strong in that. And I don't think we have to have them all, but I think it's probably worth being in a community where they're all being expressed. So, I'm going to pause for a moment. I'd just like you to think for a moment, ask God, what have you naturally made me strong in? What's really strongest? I'm trying to make a practice of giving a chance for people to make a comment or ask a question or even give a pushback. So would anyone like to make a comment, ask a question or give a pushback?
Flourishing are the ones hungering and thirsting for righteousness. And Colin says, you know, the Jews want to be in good relationship with each other, with other people. And so immediately my brain goes to what I see on the news about what's happening to the Jews at the moment. And I'm thinking, you know, what are the religious Jews thinking about their relationships that they're presently killing with everyone, including America, but especially with those in Gaza? And this is why I think perhaps that we need the whole Bible, because the next verse comes. Flourishing are the merciful.
Yeah.
And immediately I wasn't merciful, you know. I was maybe hungering and thirsting for righteousness, but if you have got a strength in one area, you need the rest of the Bible so that you listen to what Jesus is really saying, which is to be merciful and to be pure in heart and not to be judgmental.
Beautifully described, and yes, I would echo all of that. And there is a real grief when we look at the places of brokenness where it's long-term lived out and go, oh, to hunger for better. Yep.
I'm very mindful that our church and our community and our spiritual connections are made up of a lot of different people. And we live in a home where one is a peacemaker and one is an activist. And this has challenged me, I will admit, because we need both.
All right, what I'd like to suggest, if you're not on the worship team, who are going to come up and lead us in a song, just if you're sitting next to someone that you have some connection with, just have a little chat. Maybe if you're up for it, ask, where do you think you fit in this? And then they're going to lead us in a song. There'll be, is there a final song? Yep, at the end of that, Vivian's going to come up. She's going to lead us in a benediction. And I do have the words printed on a piece of paper for you to hold here. But just have a little chat. If you're up to it, how do you lean? And I would like to flag, this is a nice thing if you feel like, oh, yeah, there's stuff here. Love for you to have the chance to pray with someone else. So it might be the person next to you. If you don't want to do it there, be fine to come and sit at the foot of the cross or just up the front and someone will pray with you. Thanks.